for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The last full U.S. combat brigade pulled out of Iraq just days after a suicide attack in Baghdad killed dozens of Iraqi army recruits. Continuing floods in Pakistan have left at least 4 million homeless, and China is expected to overtake Japan this year as the world's second largest economy. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Tom Shanker, The New York Times, Laura Rosen of Politico, and David Ignatius of The Washington Post. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Tom Shanker, the last American brigade left Iraq yesterday. Wasn't this earlier than the actual deadline?
Well, it's very interesting, Diane. We have to be careful of the words we use and the labels we apply. I mean, what the American military force in Iraq has been doing for the past 6 to 9 months is very similar to what they'll be doing throughout the rest of this year in 2011. What the military did is they waved their hand and symbolically said 4-2 Striker Brigade from Fort Lewis is the brigade that's leaving and will not be replaced. So that brigade has left Baghdad, crossed the berm into Kuwait on its way back to Washington State, but there are 6 brigades left in Iraq, still 56,000 troops, whose mission officially changes on September 1st from combat to advise and assist, but that's been going on. In fact, we should note the 4-2 Striker Brigade that's gotten so much attention did not lose a single soldier to a combat death during its entire 12 months there. So clearly the mission has been changing. I think sort of a case, if we could rephrase the great John Lennon song, it's not exactly peace, but all we are saying is give the non-combat advise and assist mission a chance.
What about the contractors who are left behind? What kind of role will they play?
They will only have an increasing role. When the American military officially ends its presence under the Status of Forces Agreement at the end of next year, the State Department takes over. And we've already seen statistics that the State Department will have to hire up to 7,000 security contractors to protect its 5 hardened sites across the country. The State Department's looking at a security and operations bill of $1 billion once the American military leaves, and with it, helicopters, armored vehicles, security patrols. I don't think the American people understand the cost and the extent of the commitment to sustain whatever progress has been made.
Laura Rosen, I don't get that the State Department is going to be taking over these security measures.
Well, that's actually the point that State Department and defense officials have been trying to make this past week, is that, you know, in the effort to normalize the U.S. bilateral relationship with Iraq, the State Department will be taking the lead from the Pentagon in managing U.S. relations with Iraq. And there have actually been Defense Department and State Department officials going together to Congress to try to ask for the kind of appropriations Tom's talking about. And the state appropriators in Congress just aren't used to these $5, $6, $7 billion appropriations requests from the State Department that, you know, they spent monthly for the Pentagon in Iraq. So the Pentagon and the State Department have been quite frustrated. They had to downsize a bit the U.S. diplomatic presence that will be in Iraq over the next several years to 5 total diplomatic offices.
David Ignatius, I'm totally confused by this.
Well, welcome to Iraq. We shouldn't imply that the State Department is going to have responsibility for security. It won't. The contractors who will be coming in, many of them will be doing force protection to protect these State Department officers. They're not a military force, so they need, in today's Iraq, people to travel with them and keep them safe. A problem is that Iraq is now really kind of excited about regaining its sovereignty, excited but not always very efficacious in dealing with it. And the issue of contractors is a very, very prickly one for the Iraqis. We've had incidents in which Blackwater contractors shot people up in downtown Baghdad. So it's a real problem. The State Department's going to need people to protect them, but the people doing the protecting may be very unpopular in Iraq.
Tom Schenker, what about training Iraqi soldiers just before the brigade pulled out? You had Iraqi recruits killed in a suicide bombing.
Well, that's exactly right, Diane. Even though the overall violence levels are far, far below what they were at the worst in 2006, the insurgents and the militants are still capable of spectacular individual attacks. What's happening between September 1st, when Operation Iraqi Freedom, the invasion war plan, becomes Operation New Dawn, an advise and assist mission for the Americans, the 50,000 American military personnel that stay through the end of next year are doing exactly what you said, Diane. They will be training, advising, trying to make certain, if they can, that the Iraqi security forces can do it all once they leave at the end of 2011, unless the Iraqis ask for a continued American presence.
David.
Diane, I think when we're talking about Iraq, we ought to just note the really sad point from the standpoint of the U.S. that as this designated withdrawal of the last combat brigade happens, Iraq doesn't have a government yet. 5 months after the elections, if you want to put any kind of optimistic spin on this terrible, painful experience in Iraq, it's that the U.S. Brought democratic elections. Iraq has elected a parliament, but that parliament is frozen. In talking with an Iraqi friend of mine who's part of the government yesterday, he said they just don't see any way forward now. The administration here in Washington is working very hard to try to broker a deal between Ayad Alawi's Iraqiya faction, he's a former prime minister, and the current prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, and his state of law faction that would add a new position that presumably would be given to Alawi, where he would run a national security council and have some security. It's a kind of jury-rigged system. Mm-hmm. You know, for a country that can't make the positions it's got already work in a very functional way, the idea of adding a whole new layer strikes some people as crazy. But that's the current administration plan for breaking the logjam.
And let us not forget that the U.S. death toll, the U.S. death toll has been 4,415 soldiers, men, women, and that does not even touch the Iraqi civilians who've been killed in the process.
That's exactly right. To weave that point and the very smart point that David just made, I was having coffee with some smart Army colonels yesterday at the Pentagon, officers who've had multiple tours in Iraq. They have made peace with the sacrifice of their colleagues and comrades because they are soldiers, they're patriots. They've made peace with the initial mission for the invasion, weapons of mass destruction proving false. They've made peace with the under-resourcing of the war. But as the last combat troop leaves, as the 50,000 remaining advise and assist, what really troubles smart military officers is, will the Iraqis take advantage of the great sacrifice of American blood and treasury that's made this possible? And as David so correctly said, that's the question mark today.
Tom Schenker, he's Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. David Ignatius, the Washington Post. He's co-moderator of Post Global on WashingtonPost.com. Laura Rosen is foreign policy reporter for Politico. Do join us with your calls, your email, your tweets, and your messages on Facebook. Laura Rosen, the State Department says we're close to announcing new direct talks between Israel and the Palestinians. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and George Mitchell, the Middle East peace envoy, were supposed to be announcing, I think as we speak, at the State Department that they've got the Israelis and Palestinians to agree to come, I believe, to D.C. early next month to begin the launch of the direct talks. The administration's been trying for more than a year and a half to revive these. It's been, you know, George Mitchell has gone maybe 20, 25 times to the region. But they, you know, administration is able to say that they accomplished what they said they would at the beginning of the summer in going from proximity talks to so-called direct talks. There are a lot of skeptics in this town who, and in the region, surely, who wonder, you know, how much they've accomplished. You know, once you get them to direct talks, will the parties only realize how far apart they are? So I think, you know, we'll see how the process moves.
David.
The administration should be credited for being patient with two very recalcitrant parties and pushing them and waiting this out. I think there are two key questions that we should have in mind as we think about the opening of direct talks in early September. The first is, to what extent is the U.S. going to try to shape these talks with some guidelines, principles, parameters? There are different words that are used, but basically they mean summing up the basics of what we know a likely final settlement would involve. That's the first thing. That's been an issue of real contention.
And just to interrupt for a moment, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said that the Palestinian leaders and those of Israel will come to Washington in September to resume direct talks to address core issues in their long-running dispute.
Well, so to focus that a bit, so what do they mean by core issues, and how specific are they going to be about the issues that these talks will be about? That's one thing to keep your eye on. Second thing is some time bombs that are ticking away even as the peace talks start. The two I would cite are there's a settlement freeze that Netanyahu announced. It's going to expire in late September. And on the other side, Netanyahu's made clear the Palestinians have to accept that Israel is a Jewish state. That's part of it. Will they do that? So those are things to keep your eye on.
David Ignatius, The Washington Post. When we come back, Pakistan and other stories. And welcome back. We're in the international portion of our Friday News Roundup. We have three people here in the studio. Laura Rosen, a foreign policy reporter for Politico. David Ignatius of The Washington Post. Tom Shanker of The New York Times. Just before the break, we were talking about the announcement from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that direct talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis will take place in September here in Washington. What does that mean for us, Tom?
Well, I think it's a very interesting point, and the Obama administration certainly deserves credit, as David says, for its patience in pushing this through. But in addition to the landmines or time bombs, I think the administration is very cognizant that this can't be an open-ended, extended process. What we were hearing last night and early this morning was they would impose a one-year deadline on the talks to give some sense of urgency and direction to them.
What do you think will be the first subject of discussion, Laura?
I've been told borders is the one issue they think the two parties are probably closest on, so what the outlines of the future Palestinian state would be. The most contentious issues that could be landmines are considered Jerusalem and refugees, whether Palestinian refugees would have the right to return to Israel, which I think Netanyahu has said is a non-starter, so there would be some form of compensation or whatever to be agreed.
You know, you hear when these kinds of talks are about to take place that there are all these non-starters. How do you get beyond the non-starters to really begin substantive discussions, David?
In the past, Diane, these non-starters, these so-called final status issues, compromises have been worked out to the 99th point, and then things have broken down. That was especially true in the Clinton administration. And the way these two issues were resolved, all but resolved, was on the question of refugees, a recognition that refugees would not return to Israel itself, the current state of Israel, but would be compensated, and there were various plans for the compensation of refugees. And on Jerusalem, some status that allowed each side to say that Jerusalem was its capital and provided for some different versions, internationalization or some joint commission. But that's, there's a finessed answer to that, too. The question always is there political will to push those packages through? Mm. And we never know the answer to that.
Tom, do you have optimism? And I wonder, Laura, if you have optimism that those kinds of first or core issues can be gotten through even to begin these talks?
Well, I guess my worldview can be summarized as hope for the best but plan for the worst.
Yeah.
And I think in this negotiation they will try to work on those issues on which compromise is possible in order to build a little trust before they get to the harder issues.
Laura.
In terms of short-term optimism, there seems to be an interest from the Israelis and the Palestinians to move forward with the process at this time for a bunch of reasons. As David earlier mentioned, there's a settlement moratorium that's due to expire in September, and Abbas agreeing to go into talks is understood to mean that Netanyahu can now extend the settlement freeze in order to maintain some sort of peace process.
We've had a number of emails like this one from Nancy. She says, I don't understand your commentator's point of view. Will the Iraqis appreciate and take advantage as we leave of the sacrifices that the U.S. has made in people and treasure? I remember that the U.S. entered their country on false pretenses, killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and completely disrupted their society. What is it they have to appreciate about our being in their country? Tom, I think it was you who made the comment.
Of course. Your listener and emailer's comments are true, and true again. It's not so much appreciate, it's take advantage. I think we're all aware of the false rationale for war that got us into Iraq and for the under-resourcing and bad strategy that finally was turned around with the surge that brought the current stability. I didn't mean appreciate as in the American people deserve a thank you note, because they don't. We invaded a sovereign country, but it was a dictatorship in a land of other dictatorships. And I think there is an opportunity now for Iraq to take advantage, never to say thank you or appreciate, fair enough, but will the Iraqi people take advantage of what is truly a historic opportunity to build a better country for their people? I think we can all agree that democracy is better than dictatorship, that a free state is better than a police state. If the emailer disagrees with that, then we do have a problem.
I think that some might say that dictatorship kept that region at peace or a certain kind of peace, David.
Well, you wouldn't find Kuwaitis agreeing with that. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and you wouldn't find Saddam Hussein was not a popular leader at home or in the Arab world. He was a tough, ruthless, and in some ways effective. But I don't hear a lot of tears shed for his demise. What I think the caller should be aware of, Tom and Laura and I here, because we do the reporting, is that for all their anger towards the United States at the terrible disruption, tragedy that ensued after the U.S. invasion, there are Iraqis who caution us, don't be in a rush to leave us. Mm. in this region. There are growing numbers of Iraqis who are worried about a very powerful Iran on their eastern border. They don't want to be dictated to by Iran, and they think their only hope of resisting Iran is some kind of help, advice, guidance from the U.S. So I do hear Iraqis say, for goodness sakes, don't be in a rush to pull those last troops out. We need you.
Laura.
Oh, I just think that the kind of Iraqi ambivalence being described is shared by, in some ways, the Obama administration, the American, you know, a lot of ambivalence about the war that they inherited. And I think that this is one foreign policy issue in a kind of chaotic plate that Obama's inherited, where they've been somewhat able to say, we did what we said we would from the beginning. Obama gave a speech a couple weeks ago and echoed it again this week, saying he was able to pull out 100,000 troops, U.S. troops, from Iraq already since he took office. So, you know, for a war-weary American public as well, that's something he's been trying to speak about.
War-weary and tragedy-weary, as donations and gifts to the Pakistani people have shown, or the lack thereof. The UN held a meeting yesterday with high-level donors to try to elicit more funds for Pakistan's flood victims. The U.S. has said it will give an additional $60 million, which brings its total to $150 out of $359 million, nearly half. Why is it that so many other countries are being less than forthcoming, David?
People sometimes speak, Diane, of donor fatigue in a world that has so many problems. I'm sure that's part of it. I think the U.S., because we're so committed in Afghanistan, cares more about Pakistani internal stability and the consequences of this flooding than some other countries do. But I think people really do need to step up. This is a world that's going through the after effects of a recession. Everybody feels strapped. But boy, if ever there was a country where you ought to think about digging deep in your pocket, it's Pakistan.
Laura.
And Hillary Clinton did something interesting yesterday, because they wanted to show that the Pakistanis, that American people, not just the government, was trying to kick in assistance. So they set up at the State Department a Pakistani relief fund. You can text on your mobile phone 27722, and it will add $10 to your mobile phone bill, and it will go to the Pakistanis.
Good.
But even so, I mean, the Clintons have this emotional link to Haiti, for example, and Haiti is a couple hours off our shores, and there was immediate video image and all that. Pakistan's very far away. An earthquake, as it happened in Haiti, tragically, is a sudden event that more or less ends and the tragedy continues. Monsoon flooding was slowly building, and it will be even slower to recede. So the long-term need for Pakistan and 20, you know, and all of the displaced people is astounding. And actually, not to be cynical here, but even the $150 million of American monsoon aid is tiny compared to the $7.5 billion already earmarked by the U.S. government for an array of security and infrastructure assistance to help make Pakistan a viable country. There's already talk about reprogramming some of those funds.
And, of course, the fact that Pakistan's President Zardari was in England at the time didn't help the image.
Pakistan's political problems, especially at the top, have been dramatic during this tragedy. Zardari has seemed out of touch. His popularity was below 20% anyway with the Pakistani people. But I think that's, you know, you have a country that's racked by war, poverty, and now this terrible natural disaster without strong political leadership, and it makes people who look at it really nervous that this what you hear people saying is Pakistan on the verge of being a failed state.
Mm. Laura.
You know, the U.S. has been trying to sort of win hearts and minds by doing high-impact relief that, you know, for $150 million in some ways seems to have more impact in terms of turning Pakistani opinion about the United States, whereas all this money mentioned that's been spent on civil society and democracy and security assistance programs, there's a tremendous amount of Pakistani suspicion of American intentions. And I think they found after U.S. relief for a 2005 after 2005 earthquake that public opinion about the United States rose. This simple kind of aid can actually change minds in a way
That's the rebuilding effort, isn't it?
No, it's the immediate, like helping people who've been displaced. And
I'm glad that you had aid from India accepted by the Pakistanis, which previously had been held in abeyance.
Well, I mean, it's certainly impressive that these two traditional enemies, probably the most, well, the North Korea DMZ and the India-Pakistan border, certainly the tragically most likely scenes of a potential nuclear conflict. But it was $5 million, which I do have to point out is the sum that George Soros by himself donated. So India's large, successful country, again, every dollar helps. But if one wealthy philanthropist can match the donation of an entire country, one has to say, can't more be done?
David.
On this question of India and Pakistan, one of the week's most intriguing but underreported events described by U.S. government officials is that Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, issued a statement saying India is not the main enemy. The main enemy is the internal insurgency that we're facing. If Pakistanis would come to believe that as a nation, boy, we'd be in a different place.
Because what you've got is the Taliban moving in with assistance?
That's U.S. officials have been very worried that the areas where the flooding has been most intense, in southern Punjab, in northern Sindh, in the Swat Valley, have been the very areas where the insurgents have seemed to be making gains. And so, I mean, it cuts both ways. This flooding hits the insurgents, too. I mean, you know, their communications and their bases are knocked out. But there's been an effort to gather information about this. Is the insurgency problem growing because of the flooding? And last I checked, people didn't have good answers.
David Ignatius, The Washington Post. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. One more question. What is the significance of China surpassing Japan in the world economic system? Tom Shanker.
For the second quarter of this year, now that the economic statistics have been tabulated, China has passed Japan, so is now behind the U.S. as the number two economic power in the world.
And it's been said that 20 years from now, China will move to the number one.
Exactly.
Spot.
And whether you believe in coincidences or conspiracy, on the exact same day that economic statistic was released, the Defense Department released its annual report on Chinese military power, which again says that much of what China's doing to expand and modernize its military are the decisions of a rational global power seeking self-defense. But the Pentagon also complains that there's still very little transparency into a lot of the weapons systems and military planning that China has undertaken, and it raises great concerns about instability in this vital part of the world.
David.
I think with this news that China is now number two, it's a good time to stand back and think about the enormity of what China has accomplished. China has been growing at an average annual rate of 9.5% since it moved to free market economic policies
Repeat that number.
9.5%. You know, we think of a good growth here in the U.S. as maybe 3%. 9.5% every year since 1978 when they embraced free market policies. It is the most astonishing creation of wealth, jobs, GDP in modern world history. And, you know, we ought to not lose sight of this amazing transformation in human living standards that's taken place in our lifetimes thanks to these policies.
But what about its currency?
Well, and also, is it sustainable? There are a lot of analysts who wonder whether China has, you know, something the Soviet Union didn't do when it tried to reform, China has. It has sequentially bought off each of the important domestic constituents. The constituency that still hasn't been bought off is the villagers. That is a huge class of people. How do you expand the incredible growth that David's talked about beyond the urban, the intellectuals, the factory elite? So it is something, it's a tribute to the Chinese people, the government, the economy, but it could be a shell game that simply is not sustainable.
When you say a shell game, what you've got to do, you're suggesting, is get the wealth out into the rural areas where it has not yet reached.
Right. If you think about sort of a sign of prosperity, the automobile as opposed to the bicycle, we all remember the old pictures when, you know, the first Americans went, you know, to Beijing and bicycles everywhere. Well, there are cars everywhere now in the cities. If you do the math on trying to get a car to every village or family, or even half of them, just the gasoline intake required by China is an impossibly high number.
So the people who are living in the rural areas are still way, way suffering in poverty.
Their living standards are far below those of people in the cities, people in the coastal cities. I think in answer to Tom's question, the rates of growth of 9.5% are not sustainable, and nobody should expect that they will be sustained. The fact that a lot of China is still poor, for economists, is one reason why you'll continue to have growth as you suck, you know, lower wage labor into jobs. It's a reason why the whole thing keeps rolling. But no, we won't continue at 9.5%. Indeed, in financial markets over the past several weeks, one of the big themes has been, you know what? China is slowing. China is not the miracle engine that's going to drag the rest of the world into high-speed growth.
David Ignatius, Laura Rose, and Tom Shanker, they are all here in the studio to answer your questions after a break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
She spends all our money, and then she tells me I'm too tight.
John Mellencamp's new CD, No Better Than This, was recorded on his days off while he was on the road with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. On the next Fresh Air, a musical retrospective with John Mellencamp. Join us.
It's a clumsy
Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup. Let's open the phones now. First to San Francisco. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Morning, Diane and your guests. You know, I was very surprised the other day. I was listening to one of the network news broadcasts, and they were saying that the Obama administration has only given 4,700 tents to the people of Pakistan, and or it was camping supplies or some kind of a, you know, loose arrangement as opposed to heavy equipment and whatnot. There are 13 million people homeless, devastated. A half mile wide river turned into 18 miles wide, devastating whole cities. And the Obama administration's only given 4,700 shelter accommodations. It was the most amazing pittance that it's worse than BP, and it's certainly worse than Katrina. Katrina, you knew Bush was a bigot, and he would love.
I'm going to stop right there. Go ahead, Tom Shanker.
Right. I don't think anyone would argue with you that more can be done and should be done. A specific number of tents, I don't think, is the number. As of this morning, the Pentagon released statistics that 634,000 pounds of relief had been carried by helicopters to far-flung regions, and 269,000 pounds have been carried in by cargo planes, 900,000 pounds of relief. Part of it is in a monsoon in a relatively developed country. Tents are not really all that useful because you can't pitch them on water. A lot of the places that people are being moved to are places where the structures are still standing. Again, would not argue with you that more can and should be done. The number of tents is not the only metric I would look at.
Laura.
No, and I mean, the U.S. has given more than anybody, and Clinton went to the donors conference and in New York yesterday partly to sort of give the example that the United States was giving an additional $60 million, making it the largest donor of any country.
To Falls Church, Virginia. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. What a wonderful show. Two quick things. First, as a former speechwriter on Capitol Hill, the use of the term jury-rigged I keep hearing from time to time, and I want to point out that juries are rigged, and jury rigging is something that occurs. But the real term, as it's applied, is jerry-rigged, as in gerrymander, both named for a governor of Massachusetts in the 1840s who cobbled together districts that didn't belong together to tip an election. That the word gerrymander and jerry-rigged are named for the same person and for the same reason.
What are you referring to, Michael? What subject in this hour are you referring to?
Well, just at the very beginning, I heard about government jury-rigged coalition, and it's a jerry-rigged coalition. And it's an important etymological thing.
Okay. All right.
The thing is China. The European Union is about to undertake a comprehensive engagement dialogue with China to fix a number of things, all of which relate to problems that we have. But unlike the United States, Europe is doing it in a very systematic way, in which all the most difficult issues are upfront and being clearly articulated. It's going to be very instructive, I think, for this administration and for the Congress and for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has scuttled many China initiatives because multinationals have a different agenda than small businesses here, to have a coherent view if they want coherent results from engagement with China. I'd like to hear your guest comment on that.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead. David.
First, on the question of jury rigged, I would like Michael to have an argument with my copy editors, because every time I write jerry rigged, they cross it out and they say, no, it's jury rigged. So somehow there needs to be an authority to rule on this. In terms of China's dialogue with Europe, it is interesting. I think the Chinese dialogue with the United States has also been quite productive. I think it's one of the things this administration has done pretty well, talking about a range of issues, Secretary Clinton, Secretary Geithner. It's interesting that the Chinese, I'm told, have been buying up European debt securities, you know, these troubled securities. One reason the European, the euro is strengthening and the European situation is looking better, I'm told, is that China has quietly been coming to Europe's assistance.
Interesting. Yep. All right. Thanks for calling, Michael. And you might want to have that conversation about grammar and its appropriateness with the editors at the Washington Post. Let's go now to Dimitri in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I have a very quick question.
Sure.
I know the troops came home from their honorable service, and I thank them all for their service to our country.
Indeed.
I wonder if anyone has said anything or heard anything. What happens to the soldiers now? Some of them have been back again two or three times. Do they get discharged, or will they be assigned elsewhere?
Tom Shanker.
Sure, and some of them have been rotated in and out of Iraq or Afghanistan four or five times, not just two or three. We're in an all-volunteer army today. The program of stop loss that kept soldiers from retiring during the peak of the surge has been lifted. So those who have fulfilled their contractual obligation to the Defense Department and their armed service can retire at the appropriate time. Those who choose to stay in and continue their careers will do so. The stress and strain on the force is still a great concern, especially to the Army, even as the numbers in Iraq go down, because the numbers in Afghanistan are going up. The Pentagon just yesterday released the latest suicide figures for the Army. They were down slightly this month as opposed to the prior month, but it's still a significant problem, significant
concern.
Might
they actually be those who stay in, might they be sent to Afghanistan?
I would say if you are a member of the ground forces today coming out of Iraq, after you have your 12 or 15 or 18 months at home to relax, reset, and retrain, if you deploy again, you better start learning Pashto.
Oh, boy. And while we're on the subject of the Department of Defense, what about the announcement by Secretary of Defense Gates that he is planning to retire sometime this year, Tom?
Gambling is illegal, but the most office pools in the nation's capital are about the Gates retirement date. He has set several before. They have all fallen by the wayside. He has said 2011 because, one, the new budget will be finished in February, and that is his goal now. He's worked Afghanistan. He's worked Iraq. He's worked the infrastructure procurement. He wants to get this new refined spending document before Congress. And he also thinks that if President Obama wants to replace him with a suitably professional replacement, that person needs at least 2 years. So that would be 2011. However, the reason the office pools are remaining, Secretary Gates has set a half dozen retirement dates for himself before. They've all fallen away. And it's not hard to imagine, I know my colleagues cover politics more than I do, it's not hard to imagine that Obama, looking at a difficult reelection season, would come to probably the most respected member of his cabinet and ask him to stay on for the entire tour.
Laura, are there pools at your office?
Well, yes, because then there's all the speculation about who would get the job if he goes, and what comes up again and again is, in fact, he's almost irreplaceable. You've heard names of, like, Secretary Clinton herself has friends who've been pushing her name as a possible option, but he's very difficult to replace, and he and General Petraeus both are important validators for a president who is, you know, enmeshed in all of these incredible national security conflicts. And Gates, as a Republican, has given good juice to Obama on the Hill and on security issues. So.
David.
In any office pool about the Pentagon, I would never bet against Tom Shanker, because he's the expert. And I think Tom is... suspects that Gates could be, because his arm could be twisted by the president. Gates is a patriot. And I must say, Gates has emerged really as, I think, the dominant advisor to this president. It's fascinating, but the two have really meshed. So, you know, we'll see. Gates has a big stick. I can't see him leaving, to be honest, before the Afghanistan situation is clarified in July of next year.
All right. To Lansing, Michigan, Julika, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I was calling because I have a common concern question regarding Pakistan. When I first heard about the flooding, my mind flashed to an inconvenient truth and to those maps of migration and of how that's exactly the monsoons would get worse and worse. And I just had this fear that this is the beginning of that, or maybe perhaps a continuation, and I haven't been paying attention. And so... You know, and like you were commenting earlier, in Haiti it's a one-time event. But what if this is the beginning of a massive crisis, and what are we going to do?
Thanks for your call. An inconvenient truth. Of course, former Vice President Al Gore's film and book about global warming. Clearly, Mother Nature is not happy. But is this the start or the midpoint or whatever of some true upheaval in what's happening in this world's globe?
You know, there was a really interesting congressional research study report that Steve Aftergood at the Federation of American Scientists flagged earlier this week that came out that's on the environmental implications of Pakistan's national security. And the report suggested that the U.S. could bolster its national security by focusing more on improving Pakistan's water situation, which in some ways more than the bang for the buck it gets from doing a lot of the counterterrorism work. And it really, the report focused on the kind of destabilization that is occurring in Pakistan because of the kind of environmental degradation you're seeing.
You know, one of my guests earlier this week connected the floods in Pakistan with the fires in Russia, saying that the two were somehow a part of what's happening in this world. David.
I just don't have strong enough scientific background to be able to assess that. These interpenetrating effects are so hard to sort out. The fact that people are talking in these terms, I think, ought to heighten the demand people make for political action on these issues. I mean, you know, looking at these disasters and speculating, gosh, I wonder if, as opposed to actually doing something, is nuts.
But what do you do is the question.
You begin to reduce the amount of carbon that human beings are putting into the environment that, you know, appears to, in some ways, we don't understand very well, be linked to climate changes.
And you also think about population.
Yes, although in Pakistan, I don't think that would be. In Bangladesh, another country that often suffers from flooding, that's more. I don't think that's the heart of the Pakistan.
All right, to Gainesville, Florida. Javi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Morning,
sir. First time caller.
Thank you.
I'm calling to make basically a couple of comments or questions. The first thing we have to ask, I'm saying as an American Union Muslim who's the Army Reserve captain, and I was against the war, but it doesn't prevent me to join the, do what the best I can do, even I'm against the principle of it. The question is, why, who is the final beneficiary of the conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan in the name of the protecting American security interests? In fact, we have been destroying it. Why the media, in the right or left, or academia, doesn't ask the right question.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Who is the ultimate beneficiary is going to be a question I think people debate for a long time to come. Tom?
That's exactly right. And whether you look at the way the Obama administration has redefined the Afghanistan conflict as the AFPAC, looking at the regional implications, you know, going to war is the gravest decision any democracy can make. And it has to be made on rational and national self-interest. But there are global implications, of course.
Tom Shanker, The New York Times. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Ashland, Kentucky. Good morning, Mohammed. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much for having me.
Certainly.
I'm an American Lebanese, just like you, Diane. And I've been in this country for about 20 years now. Through the years, I've seen multiple talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. None of them have gone anywhere. How is the Obama administration putting a deadline of 1 year on these talks would affect the outcome of these talks? And would the United States be able to play an impartial role in these talks at all?
Good questions, Tom.
Well, I think the setting of a timetable of 1 year is to show that it's not open-ended. They can't stall for time. But it's also sufficient time to really roll up your sleeves and spit on your hands and get into these issues as opposed to a, you know, false four-day deadline at Camp David or something.
But, Laura, is the U.S. seen as an honest broker considering its statements regarding Israel, its total, complete support of Israel in the face of the suffering
It's interesting. There have been polling recently that shows that Obama's esteem in the Muslim world has fallen quite precipitously as people have become disappointed that he's a typical American, a president who can't deliver the Israelis or, you know, has the same foreign policy. In terms of the timeline, what's interesting is it's the Palestinians who are actually asking for it to be done in 1 year because that shows that they're only, you know, committing to going in for 1 year. It's the Israelis who wanted the fewest amount of conditions on the talks going in. So in addition to the letter from the Middle East Quartet today to the parties to come to the talks, the U.S. had to send a separate letter to assure the Israelis that the letter from the Middle East Quartet does not put preconditions on the talks.
One fact we haven't mentioned that you could argue is reason to take these talks seriously is that all parties seem to understand that it is important in terms of countering Iranian political pressure in the region to make some progress on this issue. So, you know, 1 year is the timeline we now have for Iranian progress on their nuclear weapons, if during that year something can be done that deals with this issue, you could argue that's a major step to counter Iranian influence.
What about that magazine cover that said Israel is about to bomb Iran, David?
Well, there was a very important story in the New York Times this morning by Tom's colleagues, Mark Mazzetti and David Sanger, that noted that the U.S. has said to Israel that we think there is at least a year before Iran has breakout capability, can go nuclear, because of technical problems the Iranians are having with their nuclear program, with enrichment and other aspects of it. It's an important story. The implication was we got another year and the Israelis are going to back off.
David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post, Laura Rosen of Politico, Tom Schenker of The New York Times. And just for your information, we are getting dozens of emails about jerry-rigged versus jury-rigged. You can settle that later. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.